Chapter 41.
May I pour you more champagne, mademoiselle? The waiter said. Thank you, Therese said with a smile. I'd like that. The waiter refilled the fine crystal champagne glass and gave the bottle of Moet a professional twist. Then with a click of his heels, he walked back to his station, ready to be summoned with the slightest hike of an eyebrow. He was impeccably dressed. His black hair was slicked back with shiny pomade, and a pencil-thin mustache adorned his upper lip. He possessed the perfect attitude, a bored detachment combined with undivided attention. "He's wonderful," Therese whispered. "Where did you get him?"
"Straight from the Orient Express," Austin said. Seeing the doubt in Therese's face, he added, "I confess, I borrowed him from Numa Food Services. He worked as a maitre d' at La Tour d'Argent in Paris before Sandecker hired him away to organize the Numa dining room."
"He's done an outstanding job organizing our dinner," she said. They were sitting at a table for two. The tablecloth was white, starched linen. The dishes and silverware were of an Art Deco design. Dinner was formal. Therese wore a knockout strapless black evening dress, and Austin had replaced the tux he'd ruined in the Washington dog sled race. She nodded in the direction of a string quartet that was playing Mozart in the background.
"I suppose the musicians are from the National Symphony Orchestra."
Austin's mouth widened in a sheepish grin. "They're friends from the Numa Engineering Division who get together on weekends."
"Quite good, aren't they?"
"Yes, and so was dinner. I don't know who your chef was, but..." She paused, catching the look in Austin's eye.
"Don't tell me.
The chef was Numa, too."
"No, he's a friend of mine, St. Julian Perlmutter. He insisted on cooking for us tonight. I'll introduce you later."
She sipped her champagne, and her mood grew somber. "I'm sorry, but I can't help thinking from time to time of Dr. Barker and the monstrous creatures he created. It seems like a nightmare."
"I wish it were a bad dream. Barker and his pals were very real. So were his Frankenfish."
"What a strange, terrible man he was.
I suppose we'll never know how someone so brilliant could become so evil."
"All the more amazing when you consider that his ancestor, from all accounts, was a decent human being. The original Frederick Barker saw that the Eskimos were starving and tried to stop his fellow whaling captains from killing walrus.
His genes must have been twisted during their passage from generation to generation," she said.
"Add a little God syndrome into the genetic stew, and you get a mad scientist who fancies himself as the personification of an evil spirit."
"It's ironic, isn't it?" she said after a moment's thought. "Barker was a product of genes gone wrong. It was precisely the process he used in his laboratory to create monsters from normally docile fish. I shudder every time I think of those poor, deformed creatures." An anxious look came to her eyes. "This is the end of that insane research, isn't it?"
Austin nodded. "Barker was a true genius. He wrote nothing down. He kept the notes for his genetic tinkering stored in his head. That knowledge died with him.
Still, it wouldn't prevent someone else equally as brilliant from duplicating his work."
"No, but the loopholes in the law will soon be closed. Biofish will not be allowed into the U.S. The Europeans are equally determined that frankenfish and ships will never be on their menu. Without a market, there's no incentive."
"What about the others in the Kiolia tribe?"
"Arrested, dead, or on the run. Without Barker to whip them into a murderous frenzy, I'd say it's the end of that bunch as a threat. Barker's holdings are up for grabs. The wolves are tearing his giant corporation to pieces. Now, let me ask you a question.
What's the future hold for you and SOS?
We're parting ways. I've decided that commando raids aren't my style. I have been offered a staff position as environmental counsel with Senator Graham.
Glad to hear you'll be around.
The waiter carried a black telephone over to the table. Mr. Zavala would like to talk to you, he said.
Joe's voice came on the line.
Sorry to interrupt dinner. I thought you should know that we're going to start to make the approach soon.
Thanks for the heads up. How long do we have?
Enough for one very long dance.
Austin smiled and hung up.
That was Joe calling from the control car.
We'll be landing soon.
Therry stared out the large observation window at the tapestry of lights far below. It's beautiful. I'll never forget this night. But please, tell me how you wrangled the use of the Zeppelin for a dinner date.
I had to pull a few strings. The Germans are anxious to reclaim the first airship to have landed on the North Pole. When I heard the Zeppelin was being flown from Canada to Washington, I offered the services of an experienced pilot and, in return, reserved the dining room for a few hours. It seemed the only way we could have dinner undisturbed.
He looked at his watch.
The pilot says we have time for one dance.
I'd love to.
They rose from the table and Austin offered his arm, and they strolled into the dimly lit lounge. Austin turned on a record player and the mellow tunes of the Glenn Miller Band flowed from the speaker.
Thought we should have a little period music.
Therry was staring out the observation window at the lights of the great East Coast megalopolis. She turned and said,
"Thank you for an exceptional evening."
"It's not over yet. After we land, we can have a nightcap at my place. Who knows where the evening will lead?"
"Oh, I know exactly where it will lead," she said with a dreamy smile.
He took her in his arms, inhaling the scent of her perfume, and high above the earth, they danced among the stars.
This concludes the reading of White Death by Clive Cussler with Paul Kemprikos. Copyright 2003 by Sandecker, RLLP. This full-length reading was published by arrangement with G.P. Putnam Sons, a member of Penguin Putnam Incorporated, and was produced in 2003 by Books on Tape Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. This book was read by Scott Brick.